Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their wonderful support. Now on with the show.
So welcome back. Today we conclude episode 71, where Catherine Miranda and our special guest Judy Wiseman and I will be discussing not only Melvin Dalton's famous book Men Who Manage, which was the focus of part one, but we are going to shift our discussion towards a feminist view of the topic of how managers manage. And for this, we discussed Judy Wiseman's 1998 book, Managing Like a Man. And as I ran into Judy's book, I was like, wow, this is such like a coincidence, like these two titles completely match together into a narrative. And I checked your references, Judy. I don't see a citation of Dalton's book, and I'm not sure if you were aware of how the titles connect with each other. I'd love to hear, but really looking forward to discussing your book. And perhaps we can start with, perhaps you can tell a bit about the book's background, how it came into existence.
Oh, yes. No, thank you very much. And I'm absolutely delighted to be here and have the opportunity to revisit the book, actually. And it's made me remind all sorts of things about that period. I mean, I was very lucky to get a fellowship at the Industrial Relations Research Unit at Warwick University at the time where the unit was just completely sort of flourishing. It was just known throughout the whole of Europe as the best place to do research in industrial relations, which was a big area then. So I was, you know, over the moon when I got the fellowship. And it was in the early 90s. I got there in 1992, and I was there for a couple of years. And the unit at that point, I mean, there were a lot of people who came from the trade union movement. So there was a lot of work going on, doing research in car factories, on multinational, big surveys on multinational corporations. It was really a vibrant period of time. But I can't say that there was a lot of feminist work going on there at the time. And there generally wasn't much. And I think it's worth recalling, in a sense, that, you know, the journal Gender, Work and Organizations, I mean, it was set up in 1994. I ran a workshop at Warwick in 1993 on kind of, I think it was called Gender and the Corporation or something. These issues were really kind of newly on the agenda. I mean, the two other landmark things I'd like to mention is that Joan Acker had written a piece on gendered organizations in 1990 that was kind of the classic for us at the time to really think about how gender was embedded in institutions, in organizations. And that was a very important piece. And what I thought I was going to do, because I had already written a book on working class women in cooperatives, and I'd done a lot of work on gender and technology, but I read Rosabeth Moss Kanter's book, which had come out in 1997, called Men and Women of the Corporation. That's the one that was influencing me. And particularly, she was the first person, I think, to talk about male homo sociability, right? I mean, I'd read all the feminist work by Connell. You know, there's a lot of feminist theory about gender and gender relations and how they're made. But I so remember from Kanter this notion of male homo sociability, and that a few of us were starting to think, wow, you know, there she is in 1997. Capturing this dynamics of male management and talking about then not in the way we were talking about. You know, she's talking about that then. We're in the 90s starting to think about organizations as culture. Do you remember that moment where we first thought, you know, what are organizations? They're not just structures, they're cultures. And so it was kind of building on that, taking her up and saying, okay, well, let's look at this culture and the patriarchal nature of this culture. And what's that like to live in as a man and a woman? And just sort of the last thing I really want to kind of stress, actually, is that whereas a lot of the early studies, and I was very influenced by the Chicago School and all of those ethnographic studies were incredibly important to me on men. You know, really my first book had been about women in a cooperative. It was Women in Control. And what I absolutely wanted to do and did in this book was to look at men and women, right, to study men and women, to do a comparative study in men and women. And I can remember being interviewed about the book after the book came out, and people would just assume the book was about women because it was a feminist book about, you know, it was just incredible. And I was always having to say, actually, the whole point of this book was to look at masculinity and femininity in relation to each other, to look at men and women in the corporation and those relationships. So that's the other thing I really want to stress, that comparative work was relatively new then. And I think so important for us to kind of make our points.
Thank you so much, Judy. And that's also what I saw as like a key strength of this study. And I actually, I thought there were a couple of them. One is you not only studied men and women managers, you matched them. You matched them on their position, on their educational background. And you didn't only study one organization. No, you studied five different corporations. And so you could see like how the dynamics in one case compared to the other. The other quality I found was this multi-method approach where you survey data. Well, you had amazing response rates to surveys, which like everybody doing survey research now would be jealous about. But you also managed to do a lot of interviews, and especially in one of the cases that is, I believe, discussed in chapter 5 and forward. And the final strength, I thought, which makes this book so unique, is that you didn't only study the men and women at work. You also studied work at home, and you connected like the sociology of the home and the dynamics there with how that impacted them in the workplace and the ideas that people had about women, first of all, as mothers, as caregivers, and how that impacted how they were received and their opportunity to progress in their managerial careers, and how men didn't have that label on them. I found that a big revelation, I have to say. And, you know, how should we study managers broadening or perspective? And you also mentioned that it was something that Kantor didn't do in her work and that you added to it.
No, very much so. And I mean, I can remember, you know, my silly table where I look at how many male and women managers, you know, have children and things. And, you know, and I was kind of surprised, given when I wrote the book, that there were still so many full-time wives servicing these senior managers. Like, I couldn't, you know, it's only a small sample, but I just thought, come, you know, is this really the case that, you know, that actually these male managers are building their careers and having all this servicing, and that the women are basically kind of either divorced or the kids have left home, or, you know, they've got all these kinds of ways that they're, as they're dealing with the domestic, and that this was still rather a hidden topic at this point. You know, this wasn't kind of discussed. And I remember that old phrase, was it, you know, work doesn't stop at the factory gates. It was like you did study sociology of work, you know, ended at the factory gates. And what feminists were really trying to do was saying, look, actually, we have to look at the interaction between the domestic and the, you know, the public and the private. And, you know, Carol Pateman's work was very influential for me too at that point, actually, thinking about citizenship and what does that entail and the sexual contract. And that's still a very live issue now, it seems to me.
Judy, I think it's really interesting in the book where, as you say, you illuminate almost the hidden aspect of home life for women. And I'd just be interested to know your thoughts, given the changes as a result of the global pandemic and how much more of our domestic life is more on display, certainly in terms of our working life as women and also for men. You know, is this going to herald some changes?
I mean, I think it's contradictory. I mean, we know, and I mean, I think there's been plenty of evidence and very good studies showing that actually women have borne the burden of homeschooling and housework. And actually, on average, I mean, I just heard something, I think, on the radio today. I don't know what study it was, that women are doing an hour more housework than men, you know. I mean, you know, on the other hand, you know, I'm an expert on kind of time use studies, and so I could go on forever about how much domestic labour men and women do in, you know, dozens of countries and how this has changed over time, right? What has changed over time, we know, is that men, fathers are spending more time talking to children, playing with children than they did at the time when I wrote this book. That has been a change. There's lots of kind of houseworky work that men don't participate in. There's some they do, some they don't. I'm not surprised that the overall figures are that women have borne the burden of this. And even more importantly, or as importantly, in terms of job losses, women are doing much more badly out of this kind of period, right? That both women have had to give up jobs much more than men in order to homeschool and do their domestic responsibilities. And generally where the cuts are hitting is phenomenally, you know, retail and sectors affecting women. So I'm very, very kind of worried about that, the effects on women's employment. But, you know, the other part of me thinks that actually being at home has got to change something about men's experience of what the domestic is, what it is to be home, what it is to have children there all the time, what it is to sort of engage in these things. Who knows what the future will be? I know there's a lot of talk now that the future of the office will be hybrid and that there'll be, you know, people will be doing more home. We don't know. I think it's terribly hard to sort of predict those things. But, you know, there's a possibility that this is a moment of kind of transformation, and that certainly some people will take advantage of this and some organisations to have more kinds of hybrid work, and that there will be sectors, I think, of fathers who want to take advantage of this. I mean, I remember, you know, one of the things I talked about in the book was what I call this rhetoric of regret, right? That I talked to senior managers about how do you have any regrets about your career? And the standard line I would get is, I wish I'd spent more time with my children. And then I go on to say that these men aren't facilitating younger men having the ability to have more time with their children. That was one of the things I wanted to bring out. You know, it's all very well to talk about this, but are you doing something structurally about this to kind of enable change? And they weren't doing that. But perhaps there's more awareness of that with this shift to the domestic. And so I'm kind of hopeful that it might shift the culture a bit.
I wanted to actually read one paragraph of the conclusion, which I thought captured the essence of the book very well. And then I'd love to go into some of it. And in the conclusion, on page 158, actually, I have argued that there is another dimension to this whole story about, gender management. The institutions of work, not just people, must be understood as substantively gendered. The sexual division of labor is a constitutive feature of organizations, which are in turn founded on the sexual contract sealed in the home. My analysis of the gender relations of management locates them firmly in their organizational context. What your study brought to light is that, you know, this sexual division of labor as a constitutive feature of organizations, how it's ingrained in so much of how organizations operate, of how organizational life looks like, and the culture that is brought about. And I can bring examples of my dissertation research, which I did in a Japanese multinational in the chemical technological sector, so very much adult in setting. But it was also revered in Japan as a very progressive company in terms of gender diversity. And they mentioned that in terms of HR regulation, this is a very funny one. So if you're working as a manager in a Japanese company, you often get a home from the company. They rent it to you, but you have the job rotation every 5 years. You know, it could be 3 years, could be seven, but on average 5, you rotate jobs. And it could be that, you know, today you hear that next week you will be working on the other side of the country or the other side of the world when it's a multinational. So I asked, how is it then for if, you know, the man and the woman are working for the same company? I asked, like, do you bring them together with the job rotation? And they said, no, but now we allow them to rent two apartments from the company so they can live in separate places and they both have a home. And that was like their understanding of, having diversity. And that's where you see, like, all these ideas about HR, about career promotion are inherently gendered. They're inherently based upon a model. And, it's almost like the Bourdieu theory, you know, the ones in power will hold power and they will set the rules of the game and the other ones have to live up to it.
Yes, and you were particularly, Greta, talking about mobility, the assumption that, you know, maybe I'll just pick up on where you are if you can sort of cut in a bit, but how the traditional career model is built is a male model. And one of the elements of that is that a successful career is one that entails a lot of mobility. And I mean, that's the case in academia too, right? That actually staying in one institution, which is the best thing in order to educate your children, for example, is not a good thing if you want to have a high-flying career, right? A high-flying career is one where you move a lot, and that assumes that you have a domestic partner and family that are willing to move with you. And I mean, I can actually remember as well in the 90s, it was like a new conversation to have that some men were saying that they wouldn't take a promotion if it meant moving, because actually, you know, they'd bought a house and the children were at school and they didn't want to disrupt their domestic life. And was HR going to think about these issues of family-friendly policies, right? It's only at the beginning of a discussion about family-friendly policies in organisations at this time.
Or if I can add a bit of an additional feature to that, there is also the idea that to have a high-flying career, you are single and you're extremely motivated to have that, just that. There is nothing else going on in your life that deserves your attention and your energies and your efforts. I see it a bit in academia. I'm pretty sure it's widespread and common and a bit everywhere.
No, absolutely. And I mean, one of the kind of myths that I was still bothering to explode at that time, right, was the myths that women wouldn't work as long hours as men, right? So one of my great statements is, what do you know? Here is my evidence to show that these women are working exactly the same number of hours as men, and yet they're still not getting promoted. So, you know, like that was said at that point. And I mean, when I went for my first job interview, and I will name it, it was actually at Ruskin College in Oxford. You know, I really wanted to devote my life to kind of trade union organisation. And the man running Ruskin at that point said to me, would you be able to work in the evenings? Like, literally, right? I just couldn't believe it. So, you know, I wasn't offered the job, although I said, of course I can work in the, you know, but you could still ask questions like that, right? It's at that point, it wasn't yet illegal sort of thing or not practice to ask women, actually, if they were able to work at night and weekends and things. It was standard questions still at that time.
Right, right. Yeah. And I remember the personal story of my mom, who was an elementary school teacher. And when she got pregnant of her first child, my brother, she asked if she could work part-time. And the answer of the school head was, no, you couldn't work part-time. This is like 38 years ago. You either have to quit or you were just fired. And that's also what you mentioned in your book, Judy, about how a lot of women, just before you started the study, it was just normal that when you got married, you quit your job. And that's actually still the case in a lot of companies in Japan, for instance, where now the company is not allowed to fire you because you get married, but it's the informal assumption that you resign. You resign for your job. I guess here, this is a nice bridge into the formal and the informal, like the connection between the Dalton work, where we have like the formal policies of the organization, the formal structures, the formal regulations, also about career progression, where everything looks very equal and balanced on paper. But actually it shows that, you know, in the informal atmosphere, it's very different things that matter. And in the Dalton book, it was being part of the boat club, being a Mason, like all these features that you were a white man, part of the same social community, and as much similar to the ones that were already in power. And you also bring it to the fore in your book, in one of the chapters, Judy, where you mention how, you know, all these diversity policies might be in place, promotion of women. They even had like this I think it was in CHIP, in the case that you did, where they had like these programs in place to make the management representative of their workforce, and how men just objected to it, but also how in the informal atmosphere still they were asking about all these things, like, you know, how will you take care of your children when you're working? And all these types of questions that I believe now are not, you're not allowed to ask anymore during interviews.
No, I think that's right. And I mean, you know, when I think about it now, I mean, I've had discussions with people. I mean, all of these issues are so live now. I mean, as you know, I mean, in a way, there was a bit of a kind of hiatus. And now again, particularly in Silicon Valley, for example, there's a huge discussion about the need for diversity and introducing policies for these things. And we're having exactly the same discussion about formal policies and informal practices, and in a way, perhaps even more subtle practices than we're talking about at that point. You know, that in a way, it's easy to outlaw some things or to delegitimize some things, but how difficult it is to deal with these things. And I mean, you know, one example I'd like to give, I was talking to, you know, to someone, the LSE, talking about these new policies where HR presents CVs without the sex of the person on them, you know. So this business about how blind CVs are somehow going to be more egalitarian, and how easy it is when you're sifting through CVs. And can I say, both if you're sifting through as a person or if you've got artificial intelligence doing the job for you, which is a whole nother kind of layer of embedded social assumptions, which we can come up to maybe in another podcast, how even when you're, you know, going through them yourself, how the qualities you look for sometimes mean that you can end up with an all-male shortlist anyway. You know, that the subtlety of just what a CV looks like, how things are presented, the claims you make, you know, that these things now are more subtle than they were, but very hard actually to deal with unless you have explicit kind of affirmative action policies, I think. You know, the notion that you can neutralize things by getting rid of these, you know, by using algorithms or whatever, I mean, just is not effective.
Yeah, and you're hinting at something really interesting, and that is like how, even though like explicit sexism perhaps is not as present anymore as it was at the time of the study, the implicit sexism is still very much there when you think about selection and hiring and recruitment. And, you know, like the only thing that algorithmic selection and recruitment has brought to the fore is that discrimination or the subjectivity that these algorithms reveal is just the explication of our behaviors that was implicit before. It was still there because that's the training data that these algorithms are trained on. And so it's just like in our face, how our behavior is still inherently biased and inherently gendered in terms of, you know, what are the expectations that we have of how someone presents themselves, either on paper or in an interview, or how you behave in an organization to be considered for promotion, what is good behavior, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Sorry, can I raise something? Sorry, I know I should, you know, you're...
Definitely, go ahead.
Well, I mean, the one theme we haven't touched on, and I think is rather important, that again, I was engaged with this book, but seems to me quite kind of contemporary actually, was the notion that we were somehow moving to post-bureaucratic network organizations, flatter organizations. And it was said at that time, and I just want to remind you of this, that somehow this would be great for women, right? This was the moment for women. Women had soft skills, had emotional intelligence. Remember, all, you know, it was all this discussion, you know, women were uniquely placed to take advantage of these new network organizations, and that women's style of management, and there was a whole debate about this, you know, gendered management style, and that women's kind of cooperative collective style would absolutely be the one that would flourish, you know, in the late 20th century and in these new organizations. That's one of the themes I was kind of dealing with in the book and was very interested, again, to debunk, right, that somehow, you know, women were intuitively, you know, to do with their femininity, managing in a different kind of way. And so one of the main arguments, again, of the book is really to say that actually it's the organization that was shaping management style, and that just, you know, that having a few individual women there wasn't, you know, even if there were different styles that women would like to kind of practice and live, that there wasn't space in the organization to be a successful manager unless you managed according to the dominant idea of what a good manager was, and that was institutionally set. So it was kind of trying to really debunk this notion that somehow, you know, women are soft and they're doing it differently. You know, that's still a bit of the discussion today somehow, yeah? And I mean, I'm not saying that having a substantial number of women in an organization, and it has to be a substantial number, doesn't kind of shift the culture. But just to say that thinking about feminine styles and women having this emotional intelligence, I'm not sure it's a productive way to go for us in these discussions.
Which perhaps leads us to the discussion, Judy, as well, which you address in your book, is why don't more women get to the top of these organisations as well? And in Dalton's book, he describes the leadership situation, and it's very clear that a leader is somebody who has huge social capital, but is also somebody who can deal with the confusion in organisations, who can deal with ambiguity as well, their ability to absorb, resolve, utilise conflict for personal and organisational ends. I'm just wondering, is perhaps one of the reasons, if all organisations are gendered male, is this, one of the reasons why women don't get to the top? Because it's very hard for them in these gendered organisations to assume that sort of role or to be accepted by staff as, that their power is legitimate and that they have a right to assume that kind of role and to negotiate these kind of complex power negotiations in organisations.
I mean, my sense is that many, and it's hard to generalise, but many of the women who do make it to the top in organisations are managing like men. And that's why I called the book Like It Was, that actually to be successful, you adopt similar styles. And often we know women are brought in to do very difficult jobs, whether it's in policy. We used to always say in Australia that if there was a ministry that was completely impossible to deal with, I remember, whether it's Aboriginal affairs or whatever, suddenly there'd be a woman brought into cabinet, to deal with this problem or cuts or, that there's limited parameters about what you can do as a leader, and they're very tightly set by the organisation. I guess that's what I'm saying. And I think the other important thing to say, and I did try and stress this in the book, but very few people picked up on it, was that there are many men who don't want to adopt this style as well, and don't want to act in these ways and have different priorities. And, so it's a very selective group of men as well as women who make it to the top, who are willing to exhibit particular characteristics and particular practices and live in particular ways. And so I was trying to argue that actually if we changed organisational culture, it would give space for different kinds of men as well as for women. That was always the kind of pitch I was trying to do.
Right. And I did read about that in the book, and it kind of relates to the section where you write about how female management skills were also kind of a fashion at that time, interpersonal skills, soft skills. And you mentioned that, a lot of the managers, both men and women, wanted to manage in that way, but just the financial situation of the company and the constraints they had from upper management forced them to have this hard style and be more, perhaps more masculine in terms of how they were leading their teams and their people.
Yes, but I mean, having said that, it was also the case that, one of the points I make is that somehow men were rewarded for being kind of softer and more collective, whereas somehow women weren't. That there's still these stereotypes about men and women that are kind of used and infuse other people's perceptions of them.
Exactly. That was where I wanted to get to. I just lost track of my thought. What you wrote there was that even though when men and women are managing the same, they're not perceived in the same way. And when men are adopting more what people call more feminine management styles, it's seen as, an extra skill that they have. Whereas, for women, it was just seen as being women. And in another section of the book, you write about the emotional labor that goes into management, and especially for the women, the expectations that their subordinates had about how as a female manager, you shouldn't only be a manager, but you should also, perhaps have these motherly traits to always listen to the problems that people are dealing with, etc., etc.
No, I think that's right. And also just, on an optimistic note, on a note of change, I mean, I would never have imagined a Me Too moment, actually. I really wouldn't have imagined that we would ever get to a point, that there'd be some reckoning for the sexual practices and exploitation that went on in organizations. And, you know, I went to see what, you know, there was a film about one of those famous cases, a Hollywood film, and it was just incredibly kind of good. I think set in a news, wasn't it, in Murdoch's newspapers, or, you know, just showing the sort of subtle dynamics. I mean, what was so good about that film was not only it showed the predatory men, but just showed the difficult dynamics between the women, how difficult it was for the women to support each other within that organization once these things were exposed. I thought it was kind of very good at that, actually, that these things are very difficult internally for women to engage with. And it's why we have this, you know, nonsense that so many women will say they're not feminists until you say to them, well, you know, are you happy not having equal pay to have predatory practices? Oh, no, I want all those things. I just don't want to call myself a feminist, you know, because of the negative connotations once you have that identity in an organization.
If I can chip in on a possibly unrelated note, but I will do my best to relate it to the topics. I was thinking about this idea of management and the different management styles that we've been talking about. And it came to my mind within the interviews that I did for my thesis, which were with entrepreneurs. So not managers per se, but owners of the business that also take on a managerial role, how many of them describe their business as this family unit, but also describe their role in a fatherhood term. And I was thinking that this is really good and I'm all for it, but the fatherhood metaphor has actually evolved over time. So these entrepreneurs, they're taking on a more modern take of what the father should be, and they are reflecting it within their managerial role within the business. I don't know if this has also, this kind of development has also impacted maybe the corresponding motherhood role, but I'm open to suggestions on that. So I found it interesting in terms of parallelism.
I don't have, sorry, I haven't got a response to that, sorry.
Like the discussion there, Judy, in your book as well, in that chapter about it's hard to be soft, you have a great quote from a man in the survey talking about the Thatcher factor and how essential that is. And also people who embody that, women embodying that saying, I never needed equal opportunities to get where I am, so why do they approach? I think that comes from women and men of a certain generation, actually, in my experience. I don't know if you want to talk about that.
No, I think, you know, I absolutely think that's the case, that one couldn't assume then, and I think one can't assume now, that women will necessarily promote more women. I mean, I think actually, you know, my sense is if you have enough women in an organization, what you do find, even without explicit policies, is that more women get promoted, you know, that that there have been studies of that. But you need a decent amount of women. And I mean, I was very keen when it was first the case, I think in Norway and Sweden, that they brought in quotas for having, you know, women in management positions and on boards. And I mean, Britain has been incredibly slow in doing these, you know, requiring companies to have women on boards. And it began with just having one woman. And then we had a whole debate about tokenism, because actually one woman won't make any difference. But, you know, I have found in organizations that when there's a substantial proportion of women leaders, what you find over time, if you look at that organization over time, it does seem to create a culture in which it's easier for other women to also progress. Let me just kind of put it that way.
I just wonder, Judy, if you've kept in touch with Chip, obviously it was 20 years ago now, just to see, you know, because they were at the forefront of adopting these equal opportunity policies at the time.
I haven't actually. No, I absolutely haven't. I went back to my gender and technology work. And actually what's been interesting for me is that I've the last few years been working on Silicon Valley companies. And how resonant, I mean, when I got to, and Greta knows, I mean, I spent a year at Stanford a couple of years ago and got to Stanford at the moment where suddenly there was this big issue about the kind of male culture of Silicon Valley. And, you know, and people were talking about this as if this was a really surprising new phenomenon, you know, and how the big five companies, you know, the Facebook and Google are workplaces in which people are expected to be there for incredibly long hours, so that the gym is there and the free food is there and the dry cleaners there and everything is there on the assumption that you are a young, unencumbered man and that you will spend your life within the company and you will mix with other people in the company, because actually you never have time to meet anyone else because you're spending all of your time there. And I just thought, this is a very interesting in terms of the model of a successful career in contemporary Silicon Valley companies. Doesn't this resonate? You know, even though we're now told these are flat networked organizations, that they're much more egalitarian, about which I could, you know, which there's much more rhetoric than there is reality. And actually it comes back to the point you were making, Catherine, about informal power and formal power. And in the end, actually, people have to leave Google, as we've seen in these last few weeks, if they're not happy with what is being talked about in terms of diversity policy. But, you know, very similar dynamics in terms of the assumption of what a successful career looks like.
So one thing I was interested in, Judy, is the responses that you got to the book in terms of, you know, the general response. But have you also gotten a response from the people that were included in your study?
Well, you know, what was interesting, I have to say, was that the, you know, my main sort of informant at the company, you know, told me this story, very telling story, about how just at one point they had experimented with actually giving a financial incentive to managers who hired more women in their team, right? And that this actually had surprisingly been very successful, that the year in which they'd been, that one of the criteria for a successful kind of year for that manager was, you know, the diversity of their team, if you like. And that actually there had been a backlash after that, right? That there had been quite a lot of men who had been very peeved about this, and that the company had quickly dropped this. This wasn't a thing I was, you know, was supposed to sort of talk about, but that there had been a backlash. And it reminded me very much actually of, you know, I'm sure you've all followed it, but you'll remember in Google a few years ago, a guy took a case about the fact that he felt, a white guy, about the fact that he felt like that there had been affirmative action policies within Google that had disadvantaged white men. And it was a very similar, you know, it was like there'd been this, you know, some guys had been writing letters, or, you know, again, very informal cultural kind of backlash stuff that then gets exposed where he goes kind of public with this letter. And actually Google had a, you know, they did fire him, but it was very difficult, raises very kind of difficult issues. And I guess within feminism generally, I mean, one of the things we've been grappling with for, you know, well, it's not just 40 years, but I'm sure from the suffragettes and the early women's movement, is that actually if you take power from a group of people, they're not going to be happy about it. And that we try and always say that we're just making things equal and distributing power more equally. But actually, if there are groups who've had more power than other groups, whether it's racial politics or sexual politics, there's going to be a lot of resistance when you, you know, take power away from certain groups and privilege. And actually, in the end, there are only so many positions, you know, senior positions. And, you know, if you redistribute them, then you're going to have some disappointed people. So, I mean, this is always going to be a live issue for us, I think.
Right, right. And in that sense, I'm just thinking about, you know, what is the way forward? Like, when we think about, you know, really the implications of your work, and for instance, in Dalton's work, the only position of the woman was as the housewife that was arranging the social lives, even in the context of, you know, the organization, and housewives and partners doing voluntary work that was even beyond the limits of what was allowed. They contributed their work to the organization that the partners were working. Thinking about your work, like how much position of women in the workplace is also connected to their position at home. Similar for men, like where
I think that's yeah. Right, but I mean, I have always argued that it really needs a lot of impetus from men to make change, right? That we're always the ones who are asked to make the changes, you know. And we used to, in the early days, you know, get men to run the creches at our old socialist feminist conferences, right? That was the deal, right? We wanted to organize and have conferences, they should kind of run the creche. And I mean, you know, why I talked about the rhetoric of regret was trying to get senior men to think about whether they wanted to run organizations in this way, whether there could be a push from them to say, look, actually, this isn't good for the organization, this isn't good for our lives, we want to do things in different ways. And actually, there isn't evidence, and we know this more and more, that actually working incredibly long hours isn't necessarily the way to have most profitability, to run an organization well, that we really have to kind of pitch and say, look, actually, you know, and this came up a lot during the financial crash, right? Was it good to have young guys doing risky financial transactions in this period? Would it have occurred if there had been a more balanced kind of leadership team? You know, wouldn't we make better decisions? And I argue this very much in terms of technological innovation. As you know, that I very much argue, wouldn't we be focusing on different kinds of technological developments, you know, rather than more apps, for example, to run our central heating? Wouldn't we be thinking, wouldn't we be imagining different kinds of workplaces, different kinds of technologies, if we had a more diverse workplace? And I'd argue that in terms of technological innovation, but also in terms of management practice and how organizations are structured.
Yeah, definitely. I completely agree. And, you know, we have plenty of studies that having more diverse teams leads to more innovation, better decision making, and more support for the decisions that are being made. The science is there. That's kind of the narrative here. And now it's like, okay, let's look at practice and the impact on practice. And for instance, I'm in Sweden now. So the Swedish model, for instance, is, you know, parents have 1 year of paternity leave and they have to divide it equally between both parties. And in that sense, like, you know, these affirmative action policies in the workplace, but like the Swedish government position is, you need to change things at home as well. You know, it's very normal here outside of COVID times to see two guys with their kids in a stroller having a coffee. That's normal in society. And it has triggered a change to be, you know, being a father and, you know, being out and identifying your fatherhood and being with your children is much more accepted. And that also has led to changes in the workplace in terms of, you know, if all the circumstances are the same, then the discrimination will be less against in terms of gender. If we have to look at what type of policies are there, which ones are the most powerful? Yeah, I'd love to hear your thoughts there.
No, I mean, I just couldn't agree more with you. And I think state and welfare policies are kind of completely crucial. And I mean, I also work on time and the distribution of time. And there's no doubt that countries that provide better paternity and maternity leave and childcare and all of these things are so much, you know, are so much better in terms of all of the studies of time pressure of men and women. It's just a completely different way to live. So, no, I totally agree with you. And I mean, America is the terrible outlier where on the whole what women do is rely on migrant labour to substitute for their labour because there isn't decent state support, you know, and it's a culture that epitomises a valuation of long hours, of very long hours of work. So, no, I couldn't agree more with you, actually. And I remember, you know, when we had a child, I just thought, I don't know how people work and have a baby. And I just thought Sweden, you know, this is just utopia. I just thought, God, these places exist where you can get a year's sort of leave and this is totally what you need to do, you know.
But I think sometimes even with those policies in places, there is that informal expectation. So, you know, you hear so many stories of women who have come into senior positions who still could have taken a maternity leave of 6 months, 9 months, a year. And it's almost like a badge of honor that they arrived at the office with their baby there that was 6 weeks old. So I think that is another factor in this. And towards the end of your book, Judy, you do say that men, yeah, on the whole, back in 1998, I don't know if you think it's changed, are supportive of more women in the workplace and equality in the workplace, but slightly unwilling to give up the status quo or the way things are as they were then. Do you think that that's changed? I guess it depends on the country. You know, I've given some examples where things have moved on a bit further.
I think it's changed sort of hugely in some sectors, actually. And I don't think we want to leave this to people's goodwill and feelings, actually. We just want to institutionalize these changes. So it's just, you know, just like you don't now ask a woman at a job interview if she can work in the evening. You know, we've just standardized a lot of things. I think the culture's kind of changed phenomenally. I mean, you know, for all there's a lot the same, it just has to be said, honestly, when I just think back to those years in Warwick, I just think, actually, it's just been a revolution since then. You know, it just, I can't begin to tell you how differently it feels now in a university context than it did then. Just completely sort of different. So I think there has been kind of huge gains as well, and that we should, you know, we should end on a very positive note. And the gains have been made, you know, I think largely through the women's movement, through women's kind of action, like the Me Too movement has been kind of a very effective thing. But the more men join in to these pushes for change, you know, the more we'll see these change kind of ingrained and embedded in workplaces.
And in that sense, like, what we see in the new models of work that I'm studying is that more and more people are looking for a model of work that works for them, for both men and women. For instance, like, you know, these expert freelancers that work remote and through these online labor platforms, very much, you know, there's also a push from that side to yeah. have a change in the workplace.
Yeah, no, I think that's right, actually.
We're coming towards the closure of our episode, where we discussed Dalton's book on Men Who Manage, and also discussed Judy Weissman's book on managing like a man, and bringing in a feminist view and discussing the role of gender in management. Thank you so much for joining us, and looking forward to have you back again next time.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Finally, we would like to thank some wonderful people for supporting the show. Sarah Otner, Leon Prieto, Hadi Shaheen, Marshall Reiner, Alice Barbosa, Thomas Roulet, Heiko Schmidt, Barton Friedland, Guldem Kara Mustafa, Roberta Bernardi, Marina Timmer, Bernard Hogan, Eddie Hunsinger, Fiona Knight, Peaks Craft, Timothy Paul, Willy Leidon-Wirte, Gabriel Van Bunnen, and Clara Lux. It's easy to support the show, and all you have to do is go to our website, where a donations button will greet you. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.